Welcome to Memphis Metropolis on WYXR 91.7 FM. I'm your host, Emily Trenum. Memphis Metropolis is all about our city as an urban place, including its neighborhoods, buildings, pathways, and parks, as well as the people who shape it. Join us each week as community leaders and commentators talk with me about our shared built environment. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Memphis Metropolis at WYXR 91.7 FM. And for this show, I busted out of my home studio slash laundry room to visit the Binghamton neighborhood. And I'm here at the BDC Business Hub talking to Andy Kazee and Antoine Clark. And so welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, I've just visited, toured the hub, and there's a lot to talk about here. But I use the BDC abbreviation, but which is really Binghamton Development Corporation, which is a community development corporation serving the Binghamton community. So why don't we? Well, I like to start out by talking a little personally. So Andy, so where I really into, I really love hearing. I'm not from Memphis, but a lot of people are, like, hearing where people grew up, especially if they grew up in Memphis and what the neighborhood was. So what's your story, briefly, like, where'd you grow up, and then what was your journey like to this position at BDC?
Sure. I grew up in Ohio and came down to Memphis for the first time in college to work as a summer staff at Service Over Self.
Okay.
On Poplar in Hampton. Fell in love with the city. And have lived in Memphis or in India ever since then. So I won't go into my full story, but I practiced as a structural engineer here in town for a while, and then lived in India for 7 years with my wife and our kids, doing engineering and architecture in a development setting in India. And then I was looking for an opportunity to get involved in redemptive employment back here in Memphis, and it was the right time to do that here at the BDC, and so moved back into the Binghamton community 3 years ago.
Okay, great. How about you, Antoine?
Yeah. So, what was my journey? I've been in Memphis all my life.
So okay. What neighborhood did you grow up in?
South Memphis.
Okay.
Community 38106.
Okay.
Also known as Soulsville community.
Right.
Yeah, so third generation, grew up in the neighborhood, and got involved in some community work, by way after school, but then went to Bible college, got involved in community development, found out I really had a deep love for it, and I was doing some work that we're now doing here in faith and finance and work life, which was a curriculum that was designed to go into disenfranchised communities, teaching job readiness with a gospel component, as well as financial literacy. Andy reached out to me one day and, wanted to know if I knew of anybody that, was willing to take on a role that he had opened up. And it was a good fit.
So what is your position now? I should have introduced Andy. You're the you're not the executive director since BDC is bigger. So you're, the director of the...
Of the business hub.
Of the business hub.
And I'm the employee development manager.
Okay, so you work directly with the people in the program, which we're going to talk about. So do you still live in South Memphis, or do you live in Binghamton or somewhere else?
I do still live in South Memphis.
Okay, that's a great neighborhood.
Yeah, it is. I've seen the changes. So just kind of in conversation with somebody maybe earlier today, talking about how it's a different makeup. It's not a lot of chaos going on. Of course there's always something, but definitely seeing it quiet down. So
that's good. Quiet is good.
It is.
So okay. Well, so tell me about the Binghamton Development Corporation, which has been around for a while and does a lot, has, a housing program, and so give me the elevator speech for that, if you would.
Yeah, BDC's been around for 20 years and has been investing in people and in places in the neighborhood. And so on the places side, it looks like affordable housing development, whether it's single family homes, building or renovation and renting it out, or to multifamily units, to commercial spaces. We're involved in bringing the first grocery store for a long time into the neighborhood a few years ago before COVID. And then on the people side, it's looked like different things as well, but from youth engagement, after school programs, to spawning a lot of other organizations like and hosting them, like Carpenter Art Garden or Icon Ministries. But it's for 15 years, it's always had a workforce development component to the organization. And so it was a construction-based job training program for about 13 or 14 of those years, where up to four individuals at a time from the neighborhood would come and work full-time learning basic construction trade while they build or renovate houses that the BDC was developing.
So let's talk about the before we talk about the program, let's talk about the building, because that's what I'm interested in. That's Memphis Metropolis. I always say I love talking, buildings, and I love being the people part too, but I really like the place. I mean, that's just me.
Yes.
I don't know, people who drive through Binghamton might not really know, but it's a lot of industrial, it's a lot of residential areas and neighborhoods, but there's also a lot of industrial property, and which people might not know about unless you jog off.
Right.
And in fact, there's a lot of, streets that used to connect that no longer do because they've been, at some point, and I don't even know when that was. Do you think it was like the 60s when industry came into the neighborhood?
No, earlier than that. I think from the 20s and 30s, the development of the warehouses along Broad and along Cumberland and Collins came up, spurred up around adjacent to the railroads, which are still there.
Oh, yeah, of course. That makes perfect sense. So, gradually over time, a lot of those, in fact, I would say probably a lot of them have moved out into, where there's more land and it's cheaper. And, so you had the opportunity to acquire, BDC had an opportunity to acquire a really large warehouse. And were you involved with, how did that happen? I know you had a relationship with the previous tenant, but it just kind of, people can't see we're on the radio. Then I'm like, transferring the property with my hands.
A longtime supporter and backer of the BDC has been Power Intel Corporation, which is an international group that distributes anything that hangs on a telephone pole. So they've been based here in Binghamton since the mid-60s. And they grew this facility over the course of five expansions.
And they own property on Broad, too, didn't they?
They rented property on Broad.
Okay.
They rented. And so they were looking to get out of multiple facilities and consolidate their Memphis operations under one roof. And they acquired some land out in Piperton, Collierville border.
Also knew a new big railroad hub.
That's right. And so out there amongst a lot of those warehouses, and they built a 250,000 square foot state-of-the-art, office and warehouse as their new headquarters. And they were looking to continue to invest in the Binghamton community. While their physical presence was leaving, they really thought they could leave behind a legacy with, the home of their business for 50 years. And so they contacted the BDC and I think they were probably looking more for an idea or a connection to a business user that would also have, be a good positive presence in the neighborhood.
Right.
But just so happened we had been doing a lot of research and were thinking about launching a warehouse-based job training component to the organization at the same time.
Well, I was going to ask because you said that, when we were talking earlier, you said that you felt like there was an opportunity. The construction job training program was great, but could only train so many people at a time.
Yeah.
This is an opportunity to offer employment and other opportunities to more people.
That's
so
right.
You were sort of conceptualizing that at the time that this was a sort of a, just everything kind of aligned.
That's right. The construction job training program had about four trainees at a time.
Right.
Binghamton, know, 10,000 to 12,000 residents. 30% of the neighborhood of the working age doesn't, of households don't have, aren't participating in the formal economy. So there's a lot of people who are not in the workforce for one reason or the other. So we're looking for something in the neighborhood that people could try work out. This fit the bill.
So Antoine, does the program serve people primarily from Binghamton?
Not primarily. You know, we got a mix. So we got people who are at a, I would say, short radius who can get here by Uber, that's not expensive, probably bus, bike.
Right.
But then we do have some that are further out. And so it's definitely like to think it's a good mix.
So, and what does trying out employment look like? What are the components, either one of you, what are the components of the program? We'll talk about the different kinds of recycling you do in a minute, but in terms of just the employment, getting people, you know, into the workforce, what does that look like?
So we have a long list of, I would say waiting list that got people, job seekers from all over. Word of mouth has been really strong in the community. We have a guy here who works with us named Teddy who practically knows the whole neighborhood, and they get the word out pretty good. And once people enter these doors and kind of find out what the work is about, they're telling their friends, family. So we're getting a lot of recruits in that way. We also have some partnerships with, you know, say Drug Court or Serenity Home, and, you know, just different ways that people are, you know, sending referrals our way.
And when people get accepted to the program and walk in the door, what does that look like? What happens then?
That's a great question. So we like
to, day one, you know, Emily comes. I'm enrolling in the program, if that's the right word.
Yeah. So once we accept them into the program, we like to do what we would call wraparound service to help them not just stay here in these doors, but to transition into livable wage employment is what we would call it. So being able to help them identify what type of jobs be a good fit for them. So we use an assessment called U-Science, which is allowing us to see, you know, what's a good fit aptitude-wise, what's an interest for them. If they have no idea, we've kind of understood now that many people come through the doors not really knowing what's next for them. And so we have spent some time in the classroom, 2 to 4 hours a week, just talking about, you know, job readiness type of curriculum that we go through in faith and finance, that we go through. People getting a real deep dive and just a pause is what we would like to call it, over and over again in the classroom setting.
A pause.
A pause for them to just kind of pull away from the day-to-day work, but to also identify and talk through what does purpose look like for them, what does it feels like to be doing something that gives them, you know, that they're passionate about.
Well, have most people been in the labor force previously?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think a lot of the people that come are newly able to work or newly interested in work based on some recent, you know, situations in their life that, you know, they hadn't been able to work and now they wanted to give it a shot. And this represents a real a pretty low barrier to entry as far as employment goes, you know, for just because of our location, but also because of you know, some of the things we've set in place to really let everybody try it out as much as we can. And so it's a full-time job. So the services and the kind of wraparound services that Antoine is describing come along with a 40-hour-a-week paycheck.
So those are delivered during the work. People take advantage of that during the workday.
So those services aren't necessarily unique in themselves. There's dozens of organizations around town providing similar services. But what makes this program unique is that they're getting paid to be here, not just for those 2 to 4 hours, but for the 40 hours. And that really makes it possible and attractive to our employees who know that they want to work on these things and to, you know, put themselves on a path for a livable wage and a career that they're excited about, but can't necessarily afford to just do that because you know, so they're not, they don't have to choose between a 40-hour-a-week job and lowering these barriers for themselves.
Yeah, I can see that would be very compelling, because a lot of times, you know, if you're working 40 hours, you're having to do that in the evenings or on the weekends when you want to be with your family, and or people probably have a second job.
That's right. Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, a lot of that.
Yeah. So how many people can the program accommodate at any time?
We were aiming, we said we were aiming for 20 when we were kind of designing it. I think today we had 22, and we're interviewing six more people tomorrow.
Okay.
So, we'll see. We're not putting an upper limit on it. As much work as we can get in, we'll hire to support it.
Well, and we'll talk a little bit, as I said in a minute, about this, something different. It sounds like some of the programs are sort of, you're taking advantage of opportunities. So it's probably sometimes you just need more people than others. So like right now, yeah. You need people. And so how long do people typically take? I know you want to help them launch into other opportunities in the community.
Yeah, so what we've seen for those who have gone to something next is generally that 4 to 5 months. We've seen a lot of barriers lowered, you know, for what it's worth for each individual, because the barriers look different. And so because the barriers look different, then there are some things that are allowing them to leave better than they came. So an example, we had one job seeker come in, practically homeless, probably doing in and out jobs, you know, and just kind of didn't seem that he would be able to fit into any workplace. But being able to give him a shot, seeing him come to a very stable environment over and over again, to see gradual change, and also helping to identify what can be the best next step for him coming through here. And so just kind of just thinking through that from an individualistic point. So we like to think of it as an individualized development plan.
It sounds like, well, I'm sure it's needed, because I'm sure some people need anger management, you know, but some people probably need help budgeting. Yeah. And yeah. I'm guessing it's kind of all over, and you're not going to get that necessarily in your typical entry-level job.
That's right.
So sometimes people cycle in and out of work. So when there's a barrier that could be reduced to help them be successful.
Yeah, so I think the one thing I could probably hang my hat on is that probably over 90% of job seekers that have come through the door, we've been able to help open up a bank account.
That's fantastic, because so many people are unbanked or underbanked, utilizing, you know, non-traditional predatory financial services, and
not realizing that they're predatory a lot of times,
and not realizing, or they know they're predatory. I mean, this is something I've spent a lot of time working on. They know they're predatory, but they need that money today to pay MLG&W, and they know they're paying a huge interest rate, but you know what? They need it because they need to keep their lights on. So it's, it's really, so I'm sure you know that, you know, United Housing is moving into the old Caritas building around the corner, and that's going to be a huge source of resources. I mean, I know BDC provides things as well, but they have, a lot of housing and financial counseling and all kinds of things that people that are going through your program would take advantage of.
We're excited about welcoming them to
the. Yes, I'm on the board of United Housing, so I'm super excited about it. And, you know, of course, I used to go to Carrot House all the time, and it's a perfect.
Yeah, me too. It's like almost my favorite restaurant.
Yeah, same here. Well, plus, United Housing is like in like Parkway Village. It's just like, it's a nice office, but it's like out in the middle of nowhere off American Way. And it just like seems so disconnected from the people. And I'm sure disconnected from the community.
Yes.
So it's it's a win-win. So I think it's going to be great for partnerships. So in terms of all the people in the neighborhood. So that's really interesting that you have that greatest success rate. I was going to ask about that because, you know, not everyone's ready. I mean, and I'm sure that's part of but it sounds like with your customized approach, you're really able to meet people where they're at.
Well, yeah, the 90% was to open up a bank account. I think we've got a much lower graduation rate.
Okay.
But really, it's too early to tell. We were 22 2 months into this program and hired 70 people, but 50 of them have been in the last 5 months. And so
okay.
Really, the ramp up has been quite aggressive this year.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Well, of course it takes a while, and there's you know, probably a new challenge every week. So
every day,
like literally every day,
Yeah. So today's challenge was I'm really busy, but someone's coming to record an interview. I'm realizing we're sort of on the radio, like tell me about the building, and then did you have to do any kind of, you're doing primarily warehousing and industrial use. So did you have to do any kind of retrofitting? Was it kind of turnkey, you just walked in the door?
We had the opportunity to do some upgrades, but they certainly weren't mandatory. PowerIntel continuously operated this 82,000 square foot warehouse from the mid 60s until they moved out in 2020. And so we were we raised some money, some capital money from some local foundations and some federal dollars to replace half of the roof. We put a sprinkler system in the entire building. We did LED lighting upgrades. We put some high volume, low speed fans in to kind of make the building more comfortable for the people doing the recycling and the warehousing for our employees. But none of those things were mandatory, but it was a good time to do them before we got busy. So anywhere between a 30 to 50 year old warehouse, that's kind of was built in five phases. So it's a bit chopped up. It's on two different levels, varying ceiling heights, and a lot of industrial users, who are looking for a greenfield building and 40 foot ceilings is not that attractive too, but, we were quite excited about the location, but the different kind of feels of spaces in the building, I think, was a good fit for a fairly random grouping of activities we've got going on in here.
Well, Memphis urban neighborhoods are full of old warehouses of various sizes, and some have been abandoned, some have been mothballed,
right.
And it's just hard to, because everyone, wants the green field in the back. And of course, now there's so much of that business is technology driven.
Right.
And I had a show with Kemp Conrad, you know him? He's an industrial real estate broker. And I did sort of an explainer on, this is how nerdy the show can get. I did a sort of an explainer on industrial real estate, which I'm very interested in. And he talked to all about that technology.
Yeah.
And everything that people now expect in that kind of,
yeah.
It was really fascinating.
Yeah. Well, you're right that neighborhoods like Binghamton across the city are, and it's not an accident that they contain or are adjacent to underutilized industrial properties. So a lot of those things.
North Memphis. South Memphis has some, but North Memphis is full of
right.
them.
And so we're just 2 years old here, but we really are beginning to catch a wider vision for the need for this type of place-based, low barrier to entry employment. And so we're beginning to kind of make plans for what else could this be in addition to just these
particular models. Space or replicating this work in other places?
Replicating this model in other parts of Memphis.
I would love to see that because there's lots of real estate.
That's right.
And some of that could be donated.
Right. That's right. And I don't know if but the EPA just awarded Memphis $1 million brownfield assessment grant. We're hoping to, the BDC is a subgrantee on that award that the Community Redevelopment Agency led and is administrating. And we're hoping to utilize some of those funds in the target neighborhoods of the grant to do beginning and environmental screening work.
Well, and I don't want to get too much in the weeds, even though I love the weeds, but is that work going to be in there? Sort of target area.
There are four target neighborhoods for that grant.
Including Binghamton.
Yeah, so Klondike, Smoky City, the Uptown community.
Right.
Soulsville, CDC, and Binghamton are the four targets. So.
Okay. Yeah, I would love, that would I love that idea. I endorse it.
Yeah.
For what it's worth. So let's talk about what you actually do here, because it's really interesting. Mm-hmm. So basically, it's recycling all kinds of really hard to recycle. I guess maybe the lighting isn't recycling, but it is. Okay. Recycling all kinds of really hard to recycle things.
That's right.
So let's talk about that. Let's talk about the new project last.
Yeah.
So how did you get started? Was it the tires?
Yes. The idea is about 10 years old in my brain. I was driving home from my engineering job and heard a radio story about a group in Nashville called Spring Back Mattress Recycling. And they were recycling mattresses and still are in Nashville and around the country in a second chance employment environment. And I was never able to get that out of my brain. I thought, you know, disassembly and recycling is just a really perfect job training entry level, can tolerate a lot of turnover activity. So
it's not difficult to learn for the most part.
That's right.
Probably the lighting piece, which we're going to talk about, is a little more technical. But
right. Began developing ideas, went to a waste and recycling conference and just started just reading everything we could and just came up with a bunch of ideas. And so somebody actually brought us this tire idea. So our first project was kind of dropped in our lap by a Memphis transportation planner who had this COVID brainstorm take tires and make bike lane barriers out of them. And she worked with a local industrial artist named Tad Pearson.
I know Tad.
Okay. So
yeah.
We
talked about it. In fact, I have a tire chair at home.
Okay.
I have a chair that he made, a crazy chair he made, and a little matching footrest.
Right. So Tad's great. And I was hired to kind of come up with some concepts. The city loved these concepts, but wasn't really interested in producing these bike lane barriers out of tires themselves, and suggested that he find an arts organization or a community development organization to maybe make them. And so
he came up with the idea.
It was him and Laura Murray came up with the idea. And so they we announced that we were getting this building, and like a week later she emailed us and said, "Hey, we've got this idea. The city's actually mostly approved it already. Do you want to run with it?" And it was perfect. So we've got 420 bike lane barriers on Broad Avenue, which is just two blocks from where our facility here. And those were installed in 2021 as a pilot project and observed for a year. And then the city has approved them for use on future bike lane projects.
Okay, that's great. All right, so I know something about, bike infrastructure. And I know that there's very strict engineering standards. Mm. You know, like bike lanes have to be a certain, like the paint has to be a certain number of inches.
Right.
It's very, so are these consistent with, all the rules and regs about?
Well, they're meant to be used in a similar way that a flex post or an armadillo barrier. They're meant to be used in equivalent ways to these other kind of mass-produced products.
Okay.
They're just made with local garbage.
Okay.
And with local labor.
Well, they're perfect. They're perfect. I ride on Broad Avenue. And first of all, those bothers, people run into them.
That's right.
They last about 2 weeks.
Right. Yeah. Ours bounce right back up.
And the armadillos are kind of big.
And
like if you drive all of them with your car, you're like...
Yeah, these.
Not that I've ever done that.
Yeah,
sound like yeah.
Yeah, we're really proud of the barrier, and there's actually 8 in Nashville as a pilot project, and they're
that you made
that we made and
okay.
installed, and they're looking to kind of license that concept from us, and hopefully people that see them in Nashville will be put in touch with us, and we're looking to sell them. To whoever wants to buy them, in addition to pursuing some more grant funding to install them and more mileage in Memphis.
Okay. So if you're just joining us, you're listening to Memphis Metropolis and WYXR 91.7 FM. I'm talking to Andy Kazee and Antoine Clark from the BDC Business Hub, and we're talking right now about recycling tires into bike lane barriers. I was trying to think what the word is, as part of BDC, the hub's larger manufacturing efforts. So, so you've gotten approval to, so the bike ped coordinator for the city is the person who would decide in this particular context, we need a, we're just going to do, you know, a shared lane, or we're going to do a dedicated bike lane, we're going to do a protected lane, all different kinds of things. So, and probably makes a decision about what kind of barrier.
Right.
So, but if they select this, they would pay for it, right?
That's right. And we would actually leverage grant funding that us as a nonprofit are eligible for. So TDEC has a tire reuse.
The Tennessee Department of Education, Environmental Conservation.
That's right.
Okay.
So they were one of the funders of our initial pilot, and they were loved how it's gone and reached back out and strongly encouraged us to apply again. So we're hoping to, you know, have a partnership with the city soon for another phase.
It's a fantastic idea. Is it being done anywhere else around the country?
With this specific product, no.
It's the ultimate win-win-win, really.
Yes. Yeah.
So it's super exciting. I'd love to see more of them. So what else do you, are you using? Do the tires just get cut up?
Yeah, we've got a machine that cuts the sidewalls off of them and splits the treads in half. They get trimmed to a specific length, specific holes or 8 holes are drilled in to accept the bolt locations. And then a road hole template is placed on the ground. And so it enables the profile of the tire, even though the widths vary, the profile of the tire is identical from barrier to barrier.
And what else do you do in the interim while you're not installing these? Are you recycling the tires in other ways?
No, we're only collecting the tires when we've got orders. So.
Okay. Because that's a big problem in Memphis, as you know.
That's right.
Tires.
There is a South Memphis recycling operation newly started up called Memphis Tire Recyclers.
Okay.
Because
tire dumping is, I mean, a huge issue. You could probably just harvest them by hand around this neighborhood if you needed them, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, so that's tires. So let's talk about styrofoam.
Yep.
Another thing that people are really, it's very difficult to reuse. It just fills up landfills. So how are you recycling that?
Yeah, we received a grant early on from the styrofoam packaging industry funds grants to put in densifiers in recycling facilities. And so we were the second nonprofit.
A densifier.
A densifier takes styrofoam, like loose styrofoam, whether it's a Chick-fil-A cup or an egg carton or the styrofoam that came around your TV or that your medicine was delivered in, and chops it up and heats it up and kind of takes all the air out of it and puts it into a format that's economical to ship to around the country to somebody who's going to turn it into something else.
It's just a big compressor.
Squeezer.
It melts it. That's a technical term.
That's right.
Melting and squeezing, right? And so what would the potential end user be using that? Not the end user, but the intermediate user, the person you're selling it to. What might they do with it?
Yeah, we're hoping to sell ours to a company in New Jersey who further processes it and turns it into picture frame molding.
Wow. Well, you know, you think it could be reused into peanuts again, unless there's some kind of in case that's not allowed.
It could definitely be made into packaging material again.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
We're more interested in a bit more durable use.
Otherwise it'd become the revolving door of styrofoam.
Right.
But, I mean, that would be better than just having it thrown away.
Definitely.
So... yeah, probably has industrial uses like in auto manufacturing and stuff
Definitely.
I mean, they're using like hemp for car panels. So why not styrofoam in there, right?
That's right.
Okay, that's really interesting. So before we talk about lights, is there anything else?
Yeah, we've started up Memphis's first and only non-landfill option for your mattresses. And so.
Oh, right. Mattresses.
Yeah, that's right. So. If you live in the city of Memphis, you're allowed to put your mattress on your curb, and maybe once a month or so, a big machine will come and pick it up for you and throw it away. But if you don't want to stare at a mattress on your curb for several weeks, or if you don't live where city services your solid waste, there's not a whole lot of options other than paying a pretty significant fee for someone to take it to the landfill. And so we're actually collecting mattresses. We charge a recycling fee. So right now it's just from individual consumers that they come and drop them off here. Soon we'll be launching a weekly pickup route. And then next year we're going to begin ramping up sourcing mattresses from institutions and mattress retailers and different
another huge sources. Another scourge on the community. I mean, not as much as tires, but
If you look for them, you'll see them literally everywhere.
Well, yeah, people get evicted, and they're part of all of that detritus. It's very sad.
Yeah, and they take up a lot of space in the landfill. They cause a lot of problems at the landfill. So we're working in partnership with Republic Services, who operates both landfills. They've actually given us some grant funding, and they're going to be allowing us to put a trailer on their landfill sites so that people have the option of not throwing them away, but actually putting them in our trailer for recycling.
So what? What do you do with those?
We manually disassemble them with box cutters, and then there's four different materials. There's a cover. There's a felt cotton type layer. There's foam and there's steel, and all of those kind of go into secondary markets for further processing.
So there's customers for those. So are any of these recycling projects hazardous? I mean, do they involve people needing to mask I'm guessing if you're grinding up tires, just...
Yeah, so that we're not grinding. We've got masks and respirators that are available to the employees. When I process mattresses myself, I put my respirator on. But we're specifically, again, targeting things that people can get up to speed on really quickly, and a big hazmat certificate doesn't fit the list. So.
Yeah. Okay, that makes sense. So most people probably know that the city of Memphis is converting all of its lights, all of its street lights, to LED lighting. A process that's happening really, really fast. And if you ever wondered what's happening with all those old lights, they're being disassembled here at the BDC hub, and the materials are being recycled. And so Andy or Antoine, I'm interested in, first of all, just, you know, how you got that project. It's really cool. I would never have occurred. I do think about where's all the styrofoam going. I would never have thought where's that old street light they took down from my neighbor? Where's it going? I mean, how you sort of got plugged into that project, but also I was lucky enough to take a tour earlier, and you showed me all the different pieces. There's copper, which people steal copper. There's a lot of very valuable pieces in there, which can each have their own. And so without going. Again, too much in the weeds, but tell me about that, because it's really interesting.
Yeah. We were asked as a warehouse to be a part of a team that was bidding on this project, Memphis Streetlight Project. And we went to a similar job site just to kind of get a feel for the types of activities that were happening and where we as a warehouse provider could maybe add some value to the team and maybe do some unboxing do some things with our trainees that you wouldn't have to pay an electrician to do. And we were at this job site and started looking in some dumpsters and asking some questions, and one thing led to another. But basically, these lights normally either go into a multi-million dollar shredding operation to separate the materials, or portions of them actually get exported to Asia to separate the copper from the steel. And so we've developed this process to manually disassemble the lights and take all of that value that would have been normally, most of these lights are not going to a landfill, but a dollar is going to this person and this hauler, and so taking all that value that would have been spread out between a dozen different pieces of the recycling supply chain, and we're turning all of that into a neighborhood job training opportunity.
So when the light comes down off the pole, goes on the back of a truck and someone brings it to your loading dock.
Yeah.
And then people take it apart and all the different parts have value of it. It sounds like, didn't you say something like 90% of it could be resold?
100% could be recycled. We are not recycling the glass and some felt and a few pieces of the plastic, but all the metal is and the electronic components, the wires.
So it's you provide a job training source, but also it's a source of revenue, which presumably supports the mission.
That's right.
So and also you, it sounds like there's a few lights that were not that used, so those can be just resold.
We're attempting. We're currently testing the market to see if there's an appetite for refurbished lights. Maybe there's some municipalities out there who have not yet, or maybe don't plan to switch to LEDs, and sensed a bit of an opportunity there, and we're giving it a shot.
So as we're talking about some of these projects are sort of ongoing, like the tire or the styrofoam that could go on. But this is a big project that's happening over a relatively short period of time, over a couple of years, I guess. So what's the what's on the horizon? I mean, we talked about replicating in other neighborhoods, but what's on the horizon in terms of new things that you might be recycling?
That's right. We're looking for more opportunities to do this streetlight recycling. We've talked to some people about product destruction, maybe recalls and things like that. We really don't know. We're considering getting into motor disassembly and recycling, kind of separating the copper from the steel. We'll see what comes up.
I mean, you talked about, and I could totally see this, just sending this stuff to India. That seems like that's what we do a lot with a lot of our stuff that we don't want anymore. We just put it on a boat and send it to somebody else. But is there a cost advantage to keeping it closer, or is it people that, just kind of want to support the work and think it's, and also appreciate the true recycling of it? And not just sending it off, and you really don't know.
A little bit of both. A lot of these, other parts of the country, recycling mattresses, for example, is mandated. You're legally not allowed to throw it in a landfill. Tennessee, Memphis doesn't have, maybe this legislative drive for these green circular economies. But in a lot of cases, there's an economic opportunity to do it. There's a corporate. And kind of social motivation behind it as well.
So what didn't we talk about that you want people to know? I mean, it's really this facility's fantastic, the program's fantastic, and Antoine?
I think for me, it's just kind of coming into the know of there needs to be like an ecosystem surrounding the employees that kind of come through these doors, or any door for that matter. But there are multiple services that are needed. Again, I could talk about one individual who would need help with literacy, help with transportation, help with mental health, just kind of to be able to cross the barriers or to get into what it looked like to be self-sufficient. And I would like to think that we're doing our best to surround them with as many resources as we can while they're here. But then there's a means in which they have to go on to the next thing. And what's the fit for them, as they kind of walk away from this. So providing them with an opportunity to get a job is one thing. But then to surround them with resources to help them stay successful is a different thing. So.
Well, just having met you, I can tell people probably text you after they've left the program, just wanting to connect with you and, get some of that wisdom.
So they try to keep in touch. If they kind of drift off and want to come back, they'll text one of us.
Yeah, we've had a lot of people who quit or been been fired quite regularly. You know, a few weeks goes by, months goes by, and asked to come back, and we try to accommodate when we can.
So you have to fire people sometimes. Well, you know, they probably don't show up or whatever.
Yeah, we're a lot more lenient than your average employer, yeah, there's it doesn't work out for everybody.
Do you have employers you refer people to that are get what you're trying to do and wanna be part of that effort?
Yeah, so we see individuals identify going back to school. That's kind of one thing, or it's just. They're identifying things that they want to go into, but then I think identifying it and actually making strides to get there is another thing. And so we're just trying to figure out, like, how do we consistently walk alongside them
right.
to make those strides and not just kind of bring it up as, you know, here you go and pass them on. So we would like to think that we are making a warm handoff to them going to the next thing.
But do you have employer partners that you make the warm handoff to?
In development, yeah. It's a year from now, the answer will certainly be yes. But we're,
yeah. Yeah, you're new. I mean, yeah, I totally get that. So, okay. Well, so Andy, what else, what didn't I ask you that you want people to know?
I think we covered a lot of it. We're getting this, people might choose to use our recycling services or our warehousing services first out of a social good, and you know they know about the BDC and they want to kind of do their part and throw us a donation or a small contract, and that might be how we first get our foot in the door. But we're really hoping to continue to win their business with great service and unique service. And we really think that's the key to doing this fully here in our building here, but seeing what it might look like to do other places. And so if there are people out there who have...
Well, we didn't talk about that, the fact that you have capacity here.
That's right.
And you have capacity for people to store things, but you also do distribution.
Yeah, we're looking for... clients who need things done to their products, because you know a truck that comes in and everything's already on pallets and then sits here for a week and then goes back out, that's one person, that's the forklift operator's opportunity for him to do that. But if all those boxes need opened up, and if something needs inspected or put it in a different packaging or have a sticker placed on it or tested, those are the types of opportunities we're looking for to really create as many training slots as we can. So,
that makes a lot of sense. And I guess, you know, you ultimately want people to think of you as a social enterprise and not a charity.
That's right.
So,
exactly.
Okay.
That's the word.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense. Well, this has been super interesting. So, you've been listening to Memphis Metropolis and WYXR 91.7 FM. I've been talking to Andy Kazee and Antoine West of the BDC Hub, which is a warehouse in the Binghamton community, part of Binghamton Development Corporation, that is a job training program and also does a lot of really interesting and innovative recycling projects. So thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you.
I'm glad to be here.
You've been listening to Memphis Metropolis on WYXR 91.7 FM. I'm Emily Trenum. Memphis Metropolis airs every Monday at 1, so please tune in again next week. You can listen to past programs on our program page at wyxr.org or on memphismetropolis.com. You can also follow us and send feedback on social media. Now, stay tuned for Memphis Undercover with Nancy.